Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop mechanic and stuff it in our bindle. My name is Sam Dunnelald, and my co-host this week is Quentin Smith, a.k.a. Quins. You probably know Quins from Quins Quest, his popular RPG review channel on YouTube. You may also know him from his former work at the premier board game review channel, Shut Up and Sit Down, or his contributions to long-form games journalism at People Make Games. In short, he's one of the biggest analog games reviewers out there, and he's just a couple years into bringing his audience to RPGs. So I wanted to have him on the show. I think Quins is a smart guy, but we only get the occasional review out of him at Quins Quest, so I thought maybe I could squeeze another out of him, you know? When I invite people on, I often send along a list of game mechanics I'm personally interested in eventually covering, and Quins immediately jumped at the chance to talk about Mouse Ritter's inventory system. Mouse Ritter is an old-school dungeon-crawling game where instead of playing as elves fighting dragons, you play as mice fleeing from owls. It's not unlike any number of other old-school games like Cairn or Into the Odd, but its inventory system is the only inventory system I've ever actually liked. Does it work differently from other games? Out of raw numbers, not really. But instead of writing down a list of crap, erasing it over and over, and spending precious minutes adding up item weights, Mouse Ritter turns items into little cardboard squares, chits, like board game pieces that you put in a grid on your character sheet. It's so good. I hate tracking inventory until you turn it into a little toy that I can fiddle with. Quins and I talk about all that, how the physicality of a game can completely transform your relationship to it, and how this inventory system still feels like it's just barely cracking the door open on what could be something so much more. And this is a great time for it, because for the rest of November here, it is still Mouse Ritter Month on BackerKit. If you like the sound of this little mice game, maybe head over to BackerKit and check out all the amazing adventures people are funding for it right now. But with that, let's get into it. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. And here is Quins with Mouse Ritter Inventory Tetris. Quins, welcome to Dice Exploder. Thanks so much for being here.
Hello, Sam. I'm excited. I'm a fan of the show, and I'm ready to talk about inventories. God, what a dry intro that sounds like.
This is one of those mechanics where I feel like inventory systems at large are so completely uninteresting to me that I'm excited to have found one that is really compelling to me so that I can like tackle the topic at large. But before we get into that, I want to start with what's the game here? We're talking about Mouse Ritter. What, in your words, is Mouse Ritter? Pitch me it like you're pitching it for game night.
I'll describe you the most important thing for the people at home before I get into what I would say to my players, which is if you want to search for Mouse Ritter, it's not spelled the way you expect. It's M-A-U-S as well. So it's Mouse Knight in the Teutonic tradition. Mouse Ritter, this is what I would say to my players now. Mouse Ritter is a game in the old school Renaissance tradition, meaning the school of role-playing games that play like people think or want really classic role-playing to have felt like in the 70s. So that means that combat is often a failure state. Players are expected to use lateral thinking to get out of situations which may well otherwise kill your character. We're about as far away as we could be from like story gaming. This is why I've never tried to define the old school Renaissance on Quins Quest, because it's frankly too much work and somewhat incoherent. Because despite the fact that it draws from, there's a lot of dungeons, there's a lot of high lethality play, but at the same time, the old school Renaissance does have ideas on how to bring story and kind of lateral thinking into dungeons. Yeah. All of which is to say, Mouse Ritter is simple, it is creative, and you may well get yourself killed. What am I missing?
Did you do the part where you're mice?
Did I do the part where you're mice? I probably didn't celebrate it enough. I recently did a Quins Quest review where I described the old school Renaissance scene as, or like where I describe fantasy RPGs in general as like crabs in a bucket all trying to climb on top of each other. Fantasy settings, and yet the fact that there are so many of them makes the scene feel like the furthest thing from fantastical. And a lot of members of the OSR community got very upset about that. I will point out here on Dice Exploder that I didn't say this was like bad or that I didn't like the scene, just that a lot of these games fail to distinguish themselves, even though they're great designs from great designers. Mouse Ritter, though, we can celebrate because it actually does stand out because you play mice. And while there have been several role-playing games where you play mice, but Mouse Ritter stands apart even from those because its aesthetic is so beloved and strong and juicy and crunchy. And I'm absolutely here for it. Like, I just think it immediately is very transportive to a group of players to say, you're going to play mice, and if a rat's coming towards you, like, everybody understands that.
Yeah. There's two things on that note that I feel like are really what sets Mouse Murder apart for me. The first is, I think it's so interested in the texture, like the physicality of the game. Like, it comes in a box. We're going to get into the inventory chits and the rip-away character sheets here. But even, like, the cover of the book has this, like, hole cut in it. And it's like you're looking through a tree stump at the mouse inside, and you fold it out and the art, like, expands. Like, it's such a physical product. And, like, that's one of the things I really want to dig into today.
Yeah, and it's got, like, heft as well in terms of, like, as a product, because these are boxes, these are, like, thick hardback books that, even though the font is quite large and there's not necessarily a lot of text on the pages, it wants to take up space. And yeah. I feel that heft is also contained in the mechanics, where this is a game which really wants to do a lot with very few rules, and that's why we're talking about the inventory system. But also, one of my favorite things in the game is how it deals with factions, especially if you buy any of the campaigns that come from Mouse Ritter. It really wants your campaign to be a sandbox where there are several antagonists, and just by doing, I think, little more than rolling a d6, those antagonists work towards plots that a rule that is, like, barely longer than a few sentences is going to give the world a lot of life.
Yeah. We're going to get into all that. But the other thing that I wanted to call out up front is I think Mouse Ritter is maybe the best OSR game for conveying the play style of OSR. Mm. I'm taking this bit entirely from my friend Idle Cartoolery, who, like, reviewed Mouse Ritter and talked about it being, like, when you sit down at a table to play Dungeons & Dragons, to do, like, a classic, like, knights go and fight dragons kind of game, everyone expects that to be, like, very high, pulpy, like, the knights are going to kill the dragon. But that's really not what OSR play is about. It's much more that high lethality, like, the world is dangerous and scary thing you were saying earlier. And, like, when people sit down at the table and they're mice and you're, like, an owl flies at you, like... They know that the owl is going to eat those friggin' mice, right? Like, the owl is a dragon. Like, that's what the thing is. But, like, the metaphor of we are mice going up against an owl fits the playstyle much better than knights going up against a dragon.
Yeah, you're so right. If I've got a table of players, I actually had this just recently playing a Shadow Dark, to use play adventure that wasn't even Shadow Dark. But when I was sitting my players down to have this fantasy adventure, I had to give them a little spiel of, okay, now this isn't going to be like other fantasy games you played. You might die sooner. Yeah. You maybe want to think twice before getting into a fight. And you're totally right. I haven't considered this, but Mouse Ritter, you don't say a word as the GM. The players just get it. We're mice. We're small by definition.
Yeah. This is a topic for another episode that I'm hoping to record later this year with Idle Cartoolery. But I think that's, like, a great way of demonstrating the way that, like, a game's flavor is also a part of its, like, mechanical package.
Yes.
Right? When you switch the flavor from traditional high fantasy to mice, the way players approach the game also changes.
Oh, 100%. I had a player just this week talking about character sheets, and he was saying before the GM has even started speaking, the players are already learning the game from the character sheet. And I think, like, the role-playing game community is starting to figure this stuff out now because it's a community made up of genius designers. But the box, the cover of the book, the GM screen, if there is one, the character sheets, all of this stuff is actually, like, part of the players doing what they have to do, which is going to school to learn whatever the hell it is they're about to do.
Shout out to my Dice Explorer episode on character sheets that I did with Emmanuel Melo last year. People should go listen to that. And also, shout out to the Mouse Ritter character sheet, which I think is extremely good, in part because it comes on a tearaway pad of character sheets. Talk about also conveying the, like, high potential lethality of the game. You're literally given a pad of 100 character sheets to go through in the box.
I've also never seen a character sheet with this much space to draw your character, and
and people love that.
Yeah, my players are doodling that stuff all the time. I've also never seen such a good portrait frame for it, because usually at best you get, like, a box. Or I'm playing Kane at the minute, which gives you an ID card to draw your character in. But in this, we have a mouse hole, which your mouse is emerging from, and that's super cute.
Yeah, yeah. I love a character sheet with a ton of blank space on it like that, because it also makes it, like, very clear what are the things that are going to mechanically matter in this game. Like, fully half the character sheet is taken up by the inventory system that we're, like, about to describe. It's, like, really wants to foreground that. But I want to, on the subject of the character portrait space here, I think it being a game where you play mice also really frees people up to do that doodling. Like, I think people feel really self-conscious when they, like, can't capture the human face very
yeah,
well.
Right.
Like, the standards of it are so much higher, but I've never had people not doodle their mice and be like, it looks great, you know? Like,
yeah. Wow. This is, I hadn't considered that. This is so welcoming in terms of its rules, in terms of its industry, and also, like, it being like, you can draw a mouse. Go on, have a
go. Yeah. Anyway, I want to talk about the inventory here. So, I mean, like, I just pulled the Tearaway Paddock character sheets out of my box of Mouse Ritter, and to do so, I had to sift past the hundreds of chits, inventory little objects that the game comes with. Do you want to describe for us, like, what the inventory system looks like on the character sheet and how these external to the sheet objects fit into it?
I'd love to. So the inventory you have on your sheet is divided into squares of a standardized size. You have an inventory with six slots of squares, and this is relevant and you're not going to think it is, but it's mostly what I'm going to talk about. That grid is 2x3. So you get two rows, 1, 2, 3, then 4, 5, 6. You also have squares for what is in your hand, or as the game says, your main paw. There's two slots for your body. There's your off paw. And then the game also comes with, as you say, a bunch of these chips, which all depict items you might have. So in the core set, that's maybe a dagger or a torch or a rune that lets you cast little mice spells. The magic system in this game is something we could probably do a whole Dice Exploder about, because it is simple, but there's juice there. Or if you look at something I have next to me right now, which is the Mouse Ritter boxed campaign set, The Estate, every adventure in that comes with its own sheet of little tearaway tokens. So if players, I'm just going to pull some random items out here, they might have a plump mushroom or a moth larvae or a bath bomb or a glowing tomato or a book page. And then each of these are chits that go into your character sheet. But also, your conditions in Mouse Ritter are also chits. So from the core set, you might be hungry, injured, frightened, exhausted. And when you become, for example, exhausted, you're going to rip away a little square of that sheet and place it on your inventory, meaning you can now carry less. So rather than being able to carry six items in your backpack because you're a weak, frail little mouse who really needs to lie down, you're instead going to be able to hold less items.
Yeah. I think this is... God, where do we even want to start?
Here? I want to start by saying I was really excited that you suggested we talk about this specific system for this episode because two things, right? Listen up. First off, I love this. I think this is really good. I actually... More than just finding it delightful, I think it's important to RPG design, and I want more designers to pull from it. Also, I think it is a massive missed opportunity. I think it is a first draft of the system that I actually want to see. I may be overselling my feelings towards that, but I'm hyped.
It's fun to take a strong stance.
I'm hyped to take a strong stance. It's someone else's podcast. I'm going to come on. I'm going to throw a brick through your window, and then I'm going to leave.
Yeah.
So what are your instinctive feelings towards it?
So I looked at this system, and I'm going to walk through my like initial reactions a couple of years ago when I first encountered it. My first reaction was, hell yes. Like, this is so cool. I just want to like take the little squares and put them on the little spots. Ooh, that feels so nice.
Yeah.
My second thought was, this is mechanically identical to an inventory system that's like kind of interesting, but like, I don't give a shit about this, right?
Well, it's the inventory system from, I believe, Ken, which has been the foundation for a lot of OSR games, where you have a really limited number of slots, but in Ken, you just write down the name of like healing potion, and then that is one of the slots in your inventory.
Exactly. This is exactly what I was going to say. And then in Cairn, if you know a spell and you cast a spell, you probably get a level of exhaustion, and the exhaustion goes into an inventory slot just like it does in Mouse Ritter. I think Mouse Ritter's innovation on the conditions front is that having more conditions than just exhausted, but like fundamentally it's the same thing. And I like don't give a shit about this inventory system at all when it's in Cairn, right? Like something about the like turning it into a tactile thing is the thing that makes me go from another thing where I have to track all my stuff. Like, can I just like play the game to like, I cannot wait to like get the physical version of this game and mess around with it. And then once I have gotten this to the table, like I run one shots of this fairly often at my local one shots meetup, and it always goes over great. People love the little inventory chits, and then like almost no one uses the inventory system even during play, but just having the little chits there to fiddle with, like they're like Settlers of Catan roads that you can like build little stacks out of, that is just something people like.
Wait,
it keeps them focused,
Sam, so they can fiddle with it. Like,
record scratch moment. You run Mouse Ritter one shots occasionally, and when you play it, your players... So to be clear, I haven't played Mouse Ritter, but when you're running it, your players don't put their chits on the slots on the sheet?
They put the chits on the slot. Well, like, this is how it goes down, right? You do character creation.
I'm ready to get worked up by this.
You randomly roll your stats. You roll your HP. You roll your pips, which is the game's currency. And then your HP and your pips randomly give you a character background, like a ex-gambler or something, or a current gambler. And then that background gives you your starting inventory, right? So you get to choose a weapon, and people will, like, sift through the pile and, like, grab a dagger, right? And then they also get, like, a set of loaded dice and, like, a hand mirror or something. And then they, like, take those chits. Those are, like, custom ones, so they get to, like, write those down. They put the chits on the inventory system. And they also have torches and rations. Everyone starts with torches and rations. They put those in there. And then we start playing, and that's it. like, do the conditions come up in play? Occasionally, maybe. Do people look at their inventory and say, like, I pull out my dice and, like, do the thing? Maybe. That does occasionally happen. But, like, for the most part, people just, like, look up from their sheets and start engaging in the back and forth of, like, playing through an adventure. And so they've got this there in front of them. It's this, like, great table setting of, like, getting to know the character and, like, playing this little, like, mini game of, like, assembling the board for them. But then... it's like that gets it out of their system, you know? It's like it's there if they want to look down to it. If they're stuck, maybe they look back to the inventory system. And I think that that's generally like a great use of an inventory system. Like, get out of your way, but it's there as a prompt if you need it. And like Mouse Ritter being physical chits in squares instead of like tiny scribbled doodles on a compressed character sheet makes that easier. But fundamentally, the way Mouse Ritter functions as a game is almost like the game... doesn't happen. Like, the game disappears. The rules of the game disappear. And what we are doing is I am telling you about the two little prick rats who are running the outpost you've come to, and you're yelling up at them, and I'm yelling down at you, and, like, that's the game.
Right, okay. Like, but so, with the module, what model do you run, and does it have its own custom sheet of these little boutique tokens?
Yeah. I typically run a module called The Lonely Oak, written by Dice Exploder Discord moderator Victor Lane, which I really like. It's like 20 pages long. They're tiny little pages. You can get it on Itch for free, I believe. And I really like the setup for this. It does not come with custom chits, although it does have suggestions for some in various locations. And the game comes with like blank condition chits that you can like write in your own.
Okay. Gotcha. So we're coming at this from a funky angle, right? Because you are, you're all about this module that you really like, which does not have the custom art. On the other hand, one of the reasons I haven't played Mouse Ritter is The Estate, which is the box set that looked so exciting. It caused me to acquire The Estate and the base game. And it comes with 12 dungeons, and each of those dungeons is made by a different designer. And it all takes place, this is why it's called The Estate, in a big detached house in the countryside. So one adventure is like you going into a grandfather clock, and then another is you going into the shed where there's a cult that's been started by a mouse. And you can explore all these places. But every one of these adventures has its own sheet with... I need the people at home listening to imagine how exciting this is. Each of these sheets is in a different lovely color, and it is covered with illustrations of stuff that you might find. Like the adventure in a grandfather clock has two items that kind of resemble swords, which are an hour hand and a minute hand of the clock. And then because they're large, they are two squares by one. In that same adventure, you could find glowing liquid, blueprints, and acorn scissors. But the difference, like, if I was describing this to you as stuff you could find in a dungeon in a more ordinary game, we have to write down your inventory. These items are not necessarily exciting. But having that picture, and if you do multiple adventures, having items that have different colors because they come from different adventures, like, that is the color of the sheet for each dungeon is also a color reference for, like, where did I get this from? Oh, yeah, that tree that we went into that was on fire. Then all the items I got red. But when I say we're coming at this game from a funky direction, you've played an adventure module that you like that doesn't have these items. And I probably won't run The Estate because I don't love the dungeon design, but I am desperate to use these items because the sheets that come, I think, are maybe the best thing that come with The Estate.
I think that the strength of this inventory system, and something that I've been thinking about a lot lately as a game designer and a player, which is the difference between stuff that exists in a game that is there to be like aspirational for the, to excite you about playing or excite you about going to a particular place in a dungeon or like to be aspirational versus stuff that you're going to be like using all the time actually when you're playing the game. And an inventory system typically feels like something that you're going to be using all the time. And then in practice, it's just like annoying bookkeeping that like it's certain styles of play, it does come up more often, but a lot of the time in the kind of classic dungeon delving that I have done, people just don't care. Whereas when you make those little grandfather clock hands on little cardboard cutouts, suddenly it's not just you want to run the estate really bad. It's also your players want to go get those things. Like it makes it like those things matter. Even if they then never come up in play.
100%.
Like, even if your players never get their hands on those grandfather clock hands, and even if you never get Mouse Ritter to the table, like those things matter.
Yeah, 100%. I'm working, well, I'm not working on it, but I'm looking at a review of a game for Quinn's Quest in 2026 that I had a peculiar time reading the book because, it's going to sound crazy, it's just fun. Like there's stuff in the book that's just fun, and it's not, that doesn't mean it's like a lighthearted game or the theme of it isn't quite dark. It just means that it's like it was just this moment where I was reading it in bed, and I sort of sat up against my pillows a little bit because I was like, Jesus, when was the last time I read something that was just this straightforwardly joyous? That is what Mouse Ritter feels to me. Like getting these items that are color-coded with a little picture and sliding them into your little inventory, that's just so pleasing. But also, there's like a fun bit of like history here, because loot, and now I'm like getting really highfalutin and I'm going to disappear up my own ass, but loot is part and parcel of the source material that the OSR is drawing from, right? Like in the original Dungeons and Dragons, you leveled up by how much you could steal that wasn't bolted down and getting valuable treasure. And you can mechanicize that. You can be like, hey, if you find this necklace, it's worth 100 gold pieces, and if you go and sell it, you can buy other things and you can have more choice. But this takes that foundational, maybe even forgotten about, but nonetheless unavoidable foundation stone of the OSR, which is loot and items, and gives the players a reason to care. And like, it has that like ludonarrative, not dissonance, like assonance, that's not the word.
Resonance?
Like, resonance, there we go. Boom. Ludonarrative resonance, that they're playing a character who's, why are they doing this dangerous thing? Why are they going to this dangerous place? Well, at least partially it's to get treasure. And then giving the player that moment of joy when they unplug the minute hand from the grandfather clock and you hand them a token with an item. Like you say, that might never come up in an adventure as a solution to a puzzle. They might never sell it and turn it into pips, but they will have it on their sheet and that can just make them happy.
Well, and the way you're saying that too, like when that gambler like gets those set of loaded dice during character creation, that puts the little thought into their head, I'd like more cool things. Maybe I should go into a dungeon and like look around for stuff, you know? I want to get into some more of the like details of the like choices here, like really granular, because I also think that it's not just that like the little chits look cool and are exciting and like brightly colored and all of that. The like color coding, even in the base game, I think is really good. You have these sort of standard cream beige colored rations and torches and kind of normal items. But then the injuries, the exhaustion, the conditions are all like bright orange and really stand out. And like it makes you want to go, get this off my sheet.
Like,
and you mentioned earlier that like color coding the items from particular estate modules lets you like remember where you got those items. I think that's like a fun thing. But I also think the number of slots is really well chosen. The 6 inventory grid is like a nice stable number, but it is also like really pretty small.
Yes.
It's like not many things. Like in Cairn, you have like a 10 inventory slot.
I think it might even in Cairn, I could be wrong, but I think it might scale with your strength in Cairn as well.
Oh yeah, certainly there are other games in this genre where that is how it functions. And technically in Mouse Ritter, you know, you have 10 slots, right? You have main paw, off paw, body, six slots in your backpack, but it feels like you just have six slots because they visually chunked it out so nicely for you in a way where, like, in Cairn, it's all clumped together in one section that makes it harder to parse. And that, like, only six slots actually in your backpack feels really appropriate because you're small little mice.
Because you're mice, you know? Yeah, right?
You just can't carry very much. But it also means I can actually remember everything I'm carrying because I can remember six things. I can't remember 10 things.
Yes. Now, okay, so we've agreed that this is cute, and I think it's important because any system that can take some of the most awful shit in role-playing, which is, in terms of at least new players getting involved and trying it this time, which is that awful onboarding of rules and systems, and immediately just deletes it. And not only deletes it, not only makes it so you don't
have to... It inverts it.
It makes it
the
good.
Exciting part. It's the draw of the game. It's like putting these in front of people.
Yes, and so for that reason, I think this isn't just cute. It is genuinely important. And at the same time, have we got to the point that we can complain about this?
Yes.
Because, like, okay, so complain isn't the right word, because this to me feels like a great first draft of a system that I want to see in other games. But, so, like, they've made a game where, like you say, like, the point of the game, I mean, depending on your mileage may vary, but certainly if I was running it, I'd want to celebrate this, which is maybe the coolest individual part of a system, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think the game they've designed celebrates it systemically. Mm-hmm. And so... Mm-hmm. When we talk about the OSR, you said when your players are playing this, they don't necessarily look down at their inventories a lot, right? But the OSR games that I've chosen to celebrate on Quinn's Quest, so that's Mythic, Bastion, Land, and Mothership, the items in those games have been overwhelmingly important. And like, truly, like, yes, you might not use a particular item, but I don't know. I think about, like, one of my characters who spawns in Mothership, and on the random table, they had a six pack of beer. And then that ended up becoming this like laughable thing initially. But then a six pack of beer, you can do quite a lot with. Like, both in terms of role playing, because other players kept asking for a beer and she would be like, no, sorry, that's my last one. But then she would produce another one later. And But also, a tin of beer, if you think creatively, I mean, in the game, my players ended up emptying the beer and filling it with nitroglycerin. But the item design in the OSR, like, it wants to be broad rather than specific. So whatever circumstance your players are in, they can come up with a use for it. And I think this is where magic items or Mothership being sci-fi is really beneficial. Because if my players have a remote controlled drone or a pack of C4, you know, or a magic item that functions basically as either of those two things, then you can get creative. And Mouse Ritter, for all of the, like, colorful design of a lot of its items, there's only so many ways you can use an acorn. There's only so many ways you can use a tuning fork. And so they've got the spotlight pointed at this system, and then there's no actual sort of dancing on the stage, if I can really labor that analogy.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how much of that, for me, is just my playstyle as a GM and, like, the scenes that I am setting up and the scenes that I'm interested in. Like, I wonder if I'm just not encouraging that, or I'm playing with players who are not used to trying to make interesting, creative use of objects. Because I think sometimes, like, the fun of the game is not just that the six-pack of beer is flexible, but also in doing the, like, thinking of, like, okay, how can I use this six-pack of beer to get past a locked door? You know, like, doing that kind of creative thinking.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of going to save you here because you're like, oh, maybe I'm not GMing it right.
No, it's not that I think I'm GMing it wrong.
No, sorry, your own personal interest in how these games should be GM'd. But the point I was going to make is that when you look at the items that come with Mouse Ritter, they're like the bare bones of what you'd expect from a dungeon delving game. It's like you can have a bow or a knife, some rations or a torch. You can have armor. You can have the spells. And the spells are interesting, and I'm a huge fan of them. But that's for another Dice Exploder episode. Yeah. But then when you look at the adventure that comes in the Mouse Ritter box, which is Honey in the Rafters, it has a lot of candy-themed items. Like, you can have a candy cane, but that's a club. You can have a sugar shiv. That's a knife. You can have a slow fall petal. That's interesting. But part of the problem they run into here, I think, is that the thing with mice is that my mouse-sized objects are not as multifaceted as what Mothership can get to with a sci-fi game, where a single object in your hand could do, like, eight different things.
Yeah. I'm skimming through the, like, list of starting items here, and it is a lot of, like, that's another knife, That's another guy. Like, that's a cook pot. Yeah, that's another cook pot. And then occasionally you do get something really interesting, right? Thread, a spool of thread.
But that's your rope, right? That is like the 10-foot pole.
Right.
That there is nothing that could be more intrinsic to the OSR than that. And the reason that rope and 10-foot poles are interesting is because there is a lot of stuff you can do with them. But I don't think that the Mouse Ritter designers have thought like, okay, why is the rope and the 10-foot pole and, like, you know, the light source, why are those such interesting things to play with in the OSR? And then thought, what can we do that's like that? An object that could have like 8 different uses.
Totally. Yeah, and I think we should talk about, I don't want to get too deep into the spells, but I do think the spells, the way they work, you get like a tablet. That's one item in your inventory. And you can cast the spell in the tablet, and that maybe takes up a use or 2 or 3 of the tablet. Typically, they have 3 uses, and then they are discharged. You can't use them again until you do some sort of little mini side quest to recharge them. Like, they need to bathe in moonlight while at the bottom of a river, or you need to plug them into an electrical outlet, or like whatever the thing is.
Yeah, right? And I like that because it forces your players to be on the lookout for opportunities to do those things.
Yeah.
It's a side quest, but without a location. Like, they're often locational-based side quests where you need to be in a place or in a situation, but it's up to the players to create those situations. And ideally, you're doing that in the dungeon. So, like, can we rip off some of the bark of this tree that we're in so the moonlight gets in here? And I think that's just juicy.
Yeah. And I think that those spells tend to be flexible in the way that you are looking for from the items.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
I'll also say on the nature of the little side quest there, the way you get rid of conditions in this game is by doing some sort of little side quest. Like, in the adventure that I like, you can get covered in tree sap. And the way you get rid of the tree sap is to take a bath. And like, okay, maybe you just go back to the inn and take a bath, but maybe you're like looking around the little dungeon for a pool of water that you can wash off in, right?
I've just seen the starter adventure again, Honey in the Rafters. I hadn't seen this before. So you can get the condition Foggy Eyes, and you clear that by staring at the sun for an hour. But then it also says, do a willpower save or gain blind condition. And then the blind condition reads, cannot see, all attacks impaired. And you clear the blind condition with the tears of a fairy, which is a fabulous, like, playful, silly thing to put in front of players. That's a great start adventure thing.
Yeah. I love the, like, chain of conditions there, too. Like, that, you can imagine that just becoming the whole main A plot of the adventure.
Yeah.
It's like, we got to make this guy not blind anymore.
That's really nice, yeah.
The Badlands. Legend has it that beneath the dust, something old and powerful still whispers to any gunslinger foolish enough to listen. One day, aboard a doomed train into the wastes, 3 unlucky travelers hear that call. A runaway socialite, a shape-shifting bounty hunter, and a retired thief turned family man. Will our outcasts find what they're looking for?
I mean, we're already here. Let's have a little fun.
You really went in there, guns blazing.
I thought that was the plan.
My potions are miraculous.
I thought we were being quiet.
Oh, Stump only has 1 volume. Sorry.
Wild roses grow out of his mouth, having filled his lungs.
What's happening out there?
Violence.
Find out on Mage Hand High Five.
This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Pocket Bard, a music and soundscape companion app for your RPG home game. Back when I was editing an actual play for the Try Guys last year, we pulled some music and soundscapes from Pocket Bard, and I remain very impressed with this thing. It's an easy-to-use app on your phone. You load up a scene like Fantasy Tavern or Shipwreck Cove or Deep Space. You can adjust some sliders like how loud are the seagulls or how bombastic should the music be. And then the app just plays easy and atmospheric background music and ambiance for you and your table. And when combat starts up, you just hit the combat button and suddenly you're in an action swashbuckling soundscape to keep the energy up while you figure out whose turn it is. It's the kind of thing that I would gift to my dungeon master as a thank you at the end of a good year of playing, or maybe I'd bring as a player myself and take the burden off using it from the DM. The whole thing is just $7 a month or $50 a year. If you're outside of the US, it might even be cheaper than that as part of Pocket Bard's fair pricing commitment. Check them out at pocketbard.app. That's pocketbard.app.
Okay, so now, so long as I'm like looking at the system and getting so overexcited that I criticize it, right? I don't think this is a criticism, because I don't think what I'm about to describe is what Mouse Ritter should have done. Mouse Ritter is a straightforward game where like sometimes an item takes up two slots. But I cannot look at this game and see that they've got some items like big weapons or armor that take up two slots because it's like a 2x1 rectangle, and want someone to make the role-playing game that does Resident Evil 4 and 5 style inventory management.
Yeah.
Like, did you also think about that when you were looking at this?
100% immediately. It's like the third thought, right, after this is so cool and wow, if this wasn't chits, I'd be bored with it.
Do you want to, I'm always in my work trying to like think about welcoming people in. Do you want to describe Resident Evil inventories to people who might not have played those games?
I mean, I actually haven't played Resident Evil, so what I think of is like Diablo 2 inventory management, which I believe works fairly similarly.
Yes.
Where you're picking up items just like you are here, but each one is taking up different slots. So some of them are like 2x3 squares. Some of them are like 5x1 squares. You have like a 5x10 inventory grid, and you're like trying to carry the most valuable magic items that you have picked up from slayed demons like back to town so you can sell them, but that requires doing some Tetris to like make everything fit in your inventory properly.
It's fabulous. This might sound annoying, and I can only describe it as simply not, at least in the hands of the right designer, but finding a rocket launcher in Resident Evil and being like, oh my god, and then you open up your inventory and it's just the longest item and you're like, oh god. The thing with Resident Evil though is that in Diablo you ultimately like, it's like packing a suitcase and then you go back to town and you just unload everything and then you have an empty inventory, then you go back out. With Resident Evil, you are in a constant process of juggling this stuff around. It's like organizing a suitcase, and then if you want to leave something behind, it's you know, just gone. But of course it uses a grid-based system exactly like Mouse Ritter, and I think so. You and I are both just fantasizing about the game where the items are like awkwardly shaped and you have to decide who's going what. Also, this game absolutely crying out for a character. Well, again, maybe not this game. Maybe just the game in my imagination. But I am desperate for character classes, or maybe a mule that is a certain width. Like, let's say the mule is 2 high and 4 wide, whereas the characters are 2 high and 3 wide, which means if you ever find an item that's 4 squares long, it has to go on the mule, or it has to go to the character whose inventory is differently shaped.
Yeah.
And I just, I would love the moment as a GM to give my players a chit that long and be like, how are you going to carry it? And then not even have to explain the rules, but just have them look at their inventories and go, it doesn't fit. Yeah. And I'm like, well, then I guess you can't carry it.
Yeah, that it does some interesting stuff even in the base game. Like one of the suits of armor and like a shield, I want to say, that you can get is 2 squares wide, but it's 2 squares wide with like a little extra in the middle so that it fits perfectly on the body and the off paw squares, which are not exactly next to each other.
Oh, that's nice.
So you can't actually fit that in your inventory in 2 squares. You can only fit it in off paw and body. And I can imagine the situation where you get a 4 or even a 5x1 thing, and it's like, yeah, okay, this is taking up 3 of your backpack slots and also a body slot.
Oh,
and a main
that's
paw
so
slot
good. Yeah.
But, you know, I think the problem here is the total number of objects issue, right? Like, first of all, there's like a production problem. It'd be really hard to like make items on a tearaway sheet like this that
Wait,
are different shapes.
Yeah, you're gonna ruin my blue sky thinking where the world is great and I can play the game I want to.
I know, with actual problems. I know, but like, I am gonna do that. But the other thing is, like, if you have like a bigger grid, then you can fit more things in there, and I have to remember more things, and I don't care about that, you know?
Oh, you think so? I think I would, if I was playing this game, and like, I would 100%, if this game had character classes and it's like, you could be a fencer who can't carry much, I'm in that game, I'm not choosing the character class where it's like, you're a bit slow, but you've got a bigger inventory. I want to play the character class that can't fight at all and just carries stuff. Like, I want to be a porter. Yeah. I want to play a role-playing game where I've just got a 4x4 inventory. I'm carrying everything. And what I do in combat is throw potions or weapons to... And throw books at people. Use this spell. Like basically, but that has real world precedent. It's not absurd, because that's what squires did, right?
Totally.
Like, They just carried the knight's shit and then gave it to them when they needed it.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, yeah. And like, I think I would still be enamored with the system, but I think a more complicated grid would make it harder for my brain to keep track of what was in my inventory. So I would keep the sort of aspirational parts of the mechanic, but it would get muddier in the like usage at the table part for me personally.
Gotcha. For me, if we're talking about my dream game in this sort of like Desert Island Discs of the Mind, I want the game that so centers this inventory system that it discards other parts of the rule set. Like I don't even necessarily want stats. I just want items. And then I want to figure out how to carry and what to carry.
And the game that is entirely about that, even at the expense of like dungeon delving, you know, that's like the game that's like, okay, here's your pile of treasure, what are you taking home? Like that game is also really appealing to me. Like I think inventory systems are interesting in that I think for the most part they want to get out of the way. Like intuitively it feels like the role of an inventory system should be to get out of the way so you can do the quote-unquote real thing. And if the game said No. This whole game is doing inventory Tetris. Like, if the game is about packing your car, like, if the game is about...
Oh, my God, yes. No, there needs to be a car in the middle of the table or, like, a horse, which is carrying most of your things, yeah.
Yeah, if the point of the game is dealing with the inventory system, instead of the point of the game being, like, exploration into interesting dungeons, of which inventory system is like one component, then I am much more on board with your blue sky dream.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I'm thinking about. But of course, the point you make about like ideally inventory systems just get out of the way.
Yeah.
We can't not mention, you know, that I believe it Blades in the Dark created it, but I could be wrong there. Mm-hmm. But other games have run with where you decide what you're carrying later. You only decide if I'm carrying loads of stuff, which means I can decide on the six things I've got and I will decide that later. That's just obviously really clean.
I love the way that Blades does this to some extent, and a Trophy Gold does this to some extent, of you like lock in some of your inventory and then you have some quantum inventory. Because like the best part of the Mouse Fritter inventory system when you are actually in the middle of play is that ability to be like, huh, I don't know what to do here. I guess I will look down and see what I'm carrying. And when your entire inventory is quantum, you can't do that, right? You have to just go like, I don't know. Like you lose the joy of like figuring out how to open a door with a beer can because you can just have the beer can be a key instead.
Oh, I see what you mean. If you can always choose the correct tool for the job.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think there are benefits to not quantum inventory, and the games that are sort of splitting the difference on it, I think is a good way to do it because you still get some of that. Okay, what if I don't want to spend one of my like get out of jail free inventory slots? What can I do with what I've already got?
You know, another thing that stands out from this when I look at it is, again, this is like, I don't know, this is me being sadomasochistic in the same way I want to give my players an item that they can't actually carry. But the fact that this sheet has slots for main paw, off paw, and body, you know, what I want on this is like a belt slot as well. Because personally, I think it's interesting, not just like, do you have the slots to carry this, but what slots does it go into? And is something on your belt that you can actually use? Like, okay, so if the joy of these chits is receiving them and placing them in their place, then also give players a reason to fiddle with them. Give players a reason to like be like, oh, I think I'm going to put this on my belt. Let players slide things around all the time. Yeah. I would even go as far as to be like, if you've got a backpack, what's at the bottom of your backpack? Which makes me a lunatic, but like I would want like the inventory slots to look like a backpack, and then it's like, oh, it's at the bottom of your bag, it's gonna take longer to take out. But then the moment we're in an action sequence, nobody's allowed to touch their inventory, because if you were like sliding things around and then in your off paw you put the candy cane, I want that to become mechanicized. I want that to be a game.
I think that is the intended purpose of the body slots.
Oh, it is. I'm just saying, same as I want the inventory to be bigger and I want more of these items in different shapes.
Yeah.
I want more.
Yeah.
Because I'm a nerd.
I 100% agree. And like, I actually don't think in practice there is often enough incentive to move around the little squares. Because like, basically you like make a call on what do I think needs to be in my body slot, or your body slot is like filled up with armor, and then it's like, okay, well, I can't, now I've lost the access to that mechanic, you know? And it's only when you get like a new item where you really, you're like, is this important enough to go in the body slot? No, into the bag it goes.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas if you, I mean, Imagine if you had, because we have these square tokens that are things like, you know, Scabrous, Bloated, Dreamless. Really can't tell you how many of these there are, because every adventure comes with its own ones as well. Sneezing Fit is one I can see here. Give me things that affect my hand. Like, what happens to your fighter who uses a bow when one of their hands is, you know, mangled or has been bitten off by an owl?
Yeah, an injury that has to go in a paw slot. Yeah.
Or just, I don't know, I just, my mind can't stop racing. Like, what about an incredibly awkwardly shaped inventory item that is cursed, so you place it down and then it's like it's made out of glue. Like, or like, I mean, I guess, I think I'm, pulling, yeah, I think I'm yeah, so excited yeah. by this because I was reviewing board games before for like 10 years before I moved on to role-playing. And there are so many board games that do really cool stuff with tiles. Like, I think the glue example specifically is in lots of games of, like, once you put down this wonky-shaped Tetris tile, it cannot be moved. But there's loads of stuff you can do there. Like, I don't know, like, what about an item in your inventory that will make any item it's touching, like, you can teleport them to other players in your party, or... You know, like, if we're playing Tetris, then let's play Tetris. Let's have magic items that specifically relate to the line they're on, or the row, or connecting items, or... You know, a cursed gem.
A series of magic runes that change what they do when you put them in a different order. Or
My God, let's go. Like, let me play with tokens. We've been writing stuff with pencils for too long and we've been suckers. Maybe I'm just reverse engineering role playing into board games.
I mean, I do think this is, I think, a benefit and a weakness of this system. Like, I think we've laid out a bunch of ways in which this system inspires so much imagination, like, immediately in everyone who looks at it, and then, like, doesn't live up to all that imagination.
I mean, yeah, and of course it's not trying to. It's just
right.
using chits instead of inventory because that's a cool, simple way to do it that's more fun. But we're saying, what if someone who was obsessive about it got their hands on it and then...
I think the other thing that is, like, baked into this system as built and that, like, you also gain a little bit by leaving the promise of it so open-ended is I feel like it is really easy as a GM to make up stuff for this inventory system. Like, the game comes with a bunch of blank inventory chits and you can just say, here's the item that you found, put it on a chit, go nuts. But also the conditions in particular, the format of them, of like, here's the name of the condition, here's what happens to you while you have that condition, and here's how you get rid of the condition. It is really easy to come up with those on the fly and have them be pretty effective.
Yeah, and not only that, if you get poisoned in a game and then the GM has to explain what that is, that's tedious.
Yeah.
But in this, I can say, you're Scabrous, and then the player says, what? And then I pass them a token. And then we move on to the next player in combat because it doesn't matter. That player can read it and be like, oh no, that's so clean.
Yeah. I have an idea for a module where, like, we're going into the, like, cave full of poisonous mushrooms. And if you hang around the poisonous mushrooms too much, you get the condition that says poisoned with mushroom stuff. But if you hang around even more, you get a second condition that's like poisoned question mark. And then if you hang around even further, you get the third condition that's like actively hallucinating and now can talk to the mushrooms.
Oh,
and like,
that's fantastic.
You know, like, the idea of, actually, what if I wanted to accumulate some conditions because there was a benefit to having them? Like, I think that also is like a fun way to play on this.
Oh, that's super cool. Yeah. You know, while you were talking about like gathering more and more conditions, you gave me another idea because there's so much room to play. What about like we have to transport a moth larvae to the queen, but the moth larvae, not only do we have to feed it, but it's growing constantly. So it literally goes from like 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. And eventually it's like this 3x2 thing that a player is carrying by themselves. Or like your idea, you know, have it spread.
Well, and it's also fragile, right? So if you get hit while it's in your inventory, then it takes a condition or it becomes something else. Or like,
I would love that. Yeah. Give me a combat where I have like, oh no, the toads are running towards me. I'm going to throw the moth larvae at you. And then in order to catch it, you have to drop whatever you're holding, which means your bow is now on the floor. And also this chit system, if we're playing on a battle map or even just a sketch thing, like it's the worst illustration of all time, which is how I play any game where you need a map. If someone drops an item, it just goes on the map. So suddenly means it's not just not tedious, but actually fun to have mechanics where players have to drop things and pick things up.
Yeah, totally.
Oh my God. I'm sorry. I can't stop. Some kind of magic sword that gets hotter every time you use it which means you have
until it gives you a burn condition.
You get a burn condition, then you drop it, and then someone else has to go and pick it up. And come on, it's too good.
It's so easy. I mean, like, that is the magic of this system, because everything that we're describing, you don't need this system for that. Like you can do that in like Karen's inventory system.
Oh yeah.
But the like physicality of this and like the particular format of conditions, I think it just inspires all of that thinking. It inspires you to like hack the game. The inventory system, the moth thing that you're talking about, that's all adventure. I can like go run that right now. And it came from an inventory thing.
And,
you know?
it just shows that, like, wow, we've got so excited talking about this. But like, if your mushroom adventure, if you tell me you're poisoned, I'm like, oh, okay, what's the GM putting down? If you hand me a private tiny chit with words written on it, you've taken bookkeeping and you've made it exciting. And that is so much of what this hobby needs to do, because traditionally, certainly the OSR community, role-playing in general, Dungeons & Dragons, it's bookkeeping the game. And if we can just get away from that a little bit with... Well, look at what Daggerheart is doing, right? Trying to reduce so much of role-playing into cards. And, you know, I wish them the best of luck. I haven't played Daggerheart. But this just... Whether Daggerheart succeeds or not, the chit system in Mouse Ritter is such a great, clean example of what Daggerheart is trying to achieve there.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing to bring up specifically, because my friend Emma Costa, who actually illustrated and designed the like River Race Estate adventure here, they made this game called Exiles, which is a Forged in the Dark game, but it used this Mouse Ritter inventory system, early in development, at least. And in the process of developing it, it turned into a hand of cards. And I found that really interesting, that like suddenly you're carrying around your gear in your hand, but you're also carrying around conditions in your hand. And it had a little bit of that feeling of like Dominion curses all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And that little bit of like, okay, my character is a deck of cards. Maybe this feels a little bit like a deck builder. And like, what can we do with that instead of an inventory grid? And, you know, I think we could do 45 minutes of spitball and cool ideas with that right off the cuff.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, just, oh my God, a game where you don't have an encumbrance mechanic, so there's not a hard limit on what you can carry. But if you have 40 items, that's 40 cards or 40 chits. And if you want to look for something in particular, you have to deal yourself crap off the top as you're like, throwing stuff over your shoulder looking for that thing. Come on.
Yeah. Or like, I've got a game coming up where your character's a little like deck of cards, and it's not inventory based, but when you take wounds, you shuffle them into your deck as decks.
You
shuffle them into your deck as cards. But then the wounds are trump. Like, they're higher than any other card, because the more beat up you get, the more of a badass you
are.
Because we're doing John Wick, right? And like, you know, like just simple stuff like that feels... That's so natural. It's so obvious. It's so easy to do, but only if you are playing with cards.
Yeah, natural is the word to use. Like, all too often, I mean, I don't know. I was talking in a YouTube short about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition recently, which used cards and tokens en masse to try and create new sort of like mechanics and systems, and it all felt a little bit bloated. And I definitely wasn't a fan of it. But the idea of using cards and chits to lower the overhead is immediately just tremendously exciting to me.
Yeah. But then this is going to be kind of a downer to like go out on, but then you come back into the world of like actually physically producing the fucking thing. You know, like, I have a lot of friends who have designed games for cards and then either made those games or tried to get those games made and found that it is just so much harder and more expensive than getting a book made. And if you're a publisher, you can do that. And I hope that we get more publishers and more people who are picking up box sets like this and decks of cards and like all that good business. But also, when so much of this scene is hobbyists making games, I do understand why we haven't seen more of that.
Well, cards definitely feel like a luxury item to me. And fun bit of trivia that I only found out when I worked in the board game space. But whatever your history of like tabletop games knowledge is, it's a fact worth knowing that publishers only got the ability to create custom cards in something like either the late 90s or the early noughties.
It was like Magic the Gathering really figured out how to do it and like broke a lot of ground there,
right,
is my understanding.
Right, of course, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But so when we're talking about, like, yes, cards, luxury items, drastically increase the cost of your game, great. What Mouse Ritter does, and I would love to know about how expensive this was to produce, because we've been saying the word chit, and we mean that very literally. Like, what you get is a very thin piece of cardboard which has punchlines printed into it so you can easily rip off the chits you need. That feels to me like something that is cheap. Oh, I'm really talking out my ass here, but something that is cheaper to have in the, well, have in the back of a book. Someone has to put it there and you have to print it. Oh, I'll tell you what though. I would print and play for this. Like, this is a very trivial thing to print and play.
Although, like, when you print and play, the chits, they are, like, I want them to be a little thicker. I want them to be nicer. And, like, when I write on them with the little, like, dry erase marker that the game comes with, they don't erase very well. Like, I want something that feels better. And, like, it comes with enough of them, and you only use so many when you play that, like, if I'm losing a few to dry erase, like, who cares? And it's fine, you know? I've got plenty. But the print and play version is going to feel even worse, right? Because the print and play version is going to feel disposable, but moving little pieces of paper around on your character sheet feels like a mess in a way that moving little pieces of cardboard around
feels
great.
I think when I was talking about print and play, what I meant is that you print out a sheet and then you'd have to glue it to a very thin piece of cardboard, but then that creates something that's very hard to cut. So you'd have to, like, glue it, stick it, and cut it. And to be honest, though, one of the things that I genuinely have really loved about Quinn's Quest letting me get into role-playing games is I spend so much more of my time with scissors than I did before. Like, scissors, glue, pens, index metal clips that I can stick on notebooks. I am here for this stuff. I do wonder how much less marketable it would make a game.
I keep making games that are, like, decks of cards, and, you know, they come on a print and play kind of situation because I ain't dealing with production. I got a bigger fish to fry. But, like, they work really well for me to print and play because I have a box full of Magic cards in my fucking closet. And I have decades and decades of sleeves that I'm not using. And so it's really easy to just, like, print out the stuff and sleeve up the cards. And now I have a very good feeling thing. And not everyone has that. Yeah, maybe the thing that I should do is, like, ask people to go buy a deck of bicycle playing cards from the grocery store and, like, a pack of clear sleeves from their local gaming store and, like, come home and print out my game and put it together. And there are people I know who have done that. And I think they really like those games. I think those games feel more successful and not just mine. That's just the experience I have had hearing about this, right? But it is also, like, you should be really dedicated for that. Like, you can't just buy the game and then sit down and play it and, like...
Okay, here's what I'll end on. This is my last sales pitch for the imaginary world in which someone is considering making a print and play for their inventory Tetris game that doesn't exist yet. The reason I would be okay doing that prep is that I already have to prep stuff as a GM anyway. That's unavoidable. Mm-hmm. But the difference for me between fun prep and annoying prep is... am I prepping something that I know is going to bring a smile to my player's face? Like, if I'm writing a villain or a scene or whatever that I know my players are going to love, that's not work. That's joyous. And if you've printed off a sheet of stuff that I know I'm going to be giving to my players, like, what have I got down here? A spooky marble is one item in Mouse Ritter. There's a moth idol, a skull helmet, you know, plump mushroom. Like, getting that sheet and then knowing that every individual little thing that I've sticking onto cardboard and then cutting out, I'm going to see that player smile. That's no longer work for me. That's something I'm just excited to do.
Yeah. You know, something I've been thinking about for a year, 2 years now, I heard some interview with Tim Hutchings of Thousand-Year-Old Vampire and other RPGs talking about his process as a game designer. And what he said was, like, I don't think of myself as a game designer. I just think of myself as a guy who throws little parties for his friends. And then some of those turn out to be, like, products that I can make. And I've really been trying to, like, embrace that, both, like, in my role-playing game life, but also, like, in my life at large. Like, I do just kind of, like, throwing little parties for my friends, and, like, putting a little effort into that, like, a little elbow grease into that, it's, like, really fun. I did this, you know, I played, like, 7-part Pact this summer. We did a little weekend of it, and I just made everyone show up with a costume, and it was great. Yeah, rule. Like, that little bit of extra effort from everyone went so far.
Especially with 7-part Pact, like...
yeah. And the thing, like you know, print and play is being much more of, like, a logistical thing of, like, you know, putting either the food for this weekend or 7-part Pact. But you're right, it can be on the same side as like wearing a costume or like making a little piece of food that's going to be eaten in the game or whatever.
You know, this is maybe TMI, but with Quinn's Quest, I deal with burnout a lot. Like certainly this year, the first year of the project was fine, but now it's like, oh, I'm starting to get a little tired from running all these role-playing games. And you know, the GM prep that I've had to teach, or I've just recently learned, is very important. And you just reminded me of this with the Tim Hutchins quote about the little parties. My GM prep that I've started doing that's more important than any adventure, like I will not prefer an adventure so I can do this instead, is to put myself in a good mood. Like, that when my players show up, I smile and I'm happy to see them.
Yeah.
Those evenings are better than if I'm stressed out and I've prepared an adventure and the adventure's good, but I'm stressed. Like, people want to come to those evenings less. And so I guess, like, I'm going to sit down and cut out lots of little different candy shapes to go in my player's mice inventory, because, I don't know, that's like cocktail party behavior. Like, that's like getting the napkins set up, you know? That's like getting nice glasses for people. That analogy kind of got away from me, but I think you pick up roughly what I'm putting down.
Yeah, totally. It feels like hosting. I mean, it just feels... I love being able to give a gift to the players.
Yes.
Yeah, to my friends. That feels like a wonderful note to go out on here. So, Quinns, thanks so much for coming on Dice Exploder.
This has been a blast. I feel like I got way too excited this episode, so huge thanks to your audience for tolerating my enthusiasm.
Thanks again to Quinns for being here. You can watch Quinns Quest on YouTube right now or support the Quinns Quest Patreon for even more from Quinns. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder or on the Dice Exploder Discord. And you can find my games at sdonnewall.itch.io. Our logo was designed by Sporgory. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next time.